All right, this is Gary Parrish again, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. You get over at CBSSports.com, and I'm talking to you now on February 6th, and this episode of the podcast should be a lot of fun because I'm joined today by Seth Davis, a multi-talented man and friend who writes, of course, for Sports Illustrated, does television work for CBS Sports, host of the Seth Davis Show for CampusInsiders.com. He's the author of Wooden, A Coach's Life, which is the new book, of course, on UCLA icon John Wooden. So obviously, Seth is a very, very busy man, but he's kind enough to join me today. Seth, how you doing, man?
I've also taken up professional pole dancing. So let's add that next time I'm on, if you please.
You do have the chest for it. You absolutely do. How you been? Everything's good, right?
Everything is great, man. Life is great. Life, busy time of year, exciting time of year. I don't know whether to just enjoy the ride or just count down the days till the Final Four is over and I can lie down and take a nap.
It is funny. Like this is what we do for a living and we get, we enjoy it. Like we have jobs that we enjoy. I get overwhelmed at times, but I never feel like I'm working. And I've told this story before. Like when I was a kid, my father, every time somebody would ask him how he's doing, now he was always joking around, but every time somebody would say, hey, so how you doing? He would say, hey, just 37 more years till I retire, or just 32 more years till I retire. And I interpreted that as like, my God, he must hate his job. You know, like he is just counting down the days till he doesn't have to do it anymore. And so I am appreciative, and I know you are too, that we don't have jobs like that. I'm not counting down till I retire. I don't know that I ever want to retire. Could be forced into retirement someday, but I don't. I enjoy what I'm doing. But you do around this time of the year start to get just a little worn down, and you don't know whether to really enjoy what is the great parts of college basketball or, like you said, start counting down till we can just breathe a little bit.
Whenever people ask me, like, how do you prepare for the tournament, because they all those hours in the studio and all that information, and, guys like us, we cover the sport year-round, so it's not like I'm cramming rosters. Like, the way that I prepare for the tournament is I really try to catch up on sleep. I get in my workouts, hit some Bikram yoga classes. Like, you really got to take care. Especially guys, when we get old like us,
right.
You got to take care of both ends of that candle.
There's no question. Well, look, I want to talk to you about some college basketball topics here in a little bit. But first, I do want to talk about the book, Wooden, A Coach's Life, on UCLA icon John Wooden. I'm curious, and let's start here. I mentioned everything you do. You're a writer. You're a television guy. You host a show for Campus Insiders. You're a father. You're a husband. How do you find time to take on the challenge of also not only researching but then writing a book about somebody as important and relevant as John Wooden?
Well, it's amazing what you can accomplish if you just work all the time.
Yeah.
So, as I say, I have 4 jobs, 3 kids, and no life. But listen, I mean, college. One of the great things about covering college basketball is you have a nice long off season.
Sure.
So obviously, a lot of the work was done then. I did get quite a bit of work done during the season. Once you get to February, March, it was harder to find the time. But listen, I mean, I spent 4 years on it. The guy lived 100 years. And when you dive into a project like this, Gary, you pretty much, by the time, you have the contract with the publisher and the book is actually going to happen, you pretty much know what the book's going to be about. But you never quite know if, when you do really start digging in on somebody, do they become more interesting or do they become less interesting? And in this case, the more I dug and the more I peeled back that onion, man, he just became so complicated and nuanced and interesting to me. So I knew fairly early on that I had something really special here. And then that only ratchets up the pressure.
Sure.
To really get it right. So, I mean, you're talking about really more than 4 years of, first of all, spending, full summers in Los Angeles and enjoyed it so much that
Oh, yeah, that sounds awful.
Yeah, that was really rough. But I, in fact, I hated it so much that I moved my family over the summer. So I'm an L.A. resident now. But, just a very deep dig into primary source material, day-to-day newspaper coverage of his college career and going through archives at UCLA and the day-to-day LA Times at UCLA and magazine stories and all that. And, I interviewed, right around, I lost count, but it was right around 200 people.
Wow.
And then just, the writing and the rewriting and the editing, it's, people see it's a big book, it's 600 pages. And my answer is, well, you should have seen it before we cut it.
Right.
The guy lived 100 years. So there's a lot of ground to cover. And Gary, I really wanted to get it right. I wanted it to be fair, unflinching about, you know, exposing someone's flaws and getting into the more sensitive things, you know, like Sam Gilbert, which I'm sure we'll get into. But, sure. You know, it was 4 years of really grinding, but there was a lot of joy and a lot of gratification in that process. And now to see it out in the world and have it be read and disseminated and reviewed and talked about is pretty surreal.
And the reviews have been overwhelmingly positive. I guess that must be, you know, I've never taken on the challenge of a book. I've been presented with the opportunities in loosely before, and it just always seemed like such a daunting task to me. I almost need, and maybe it's just, I don't know why, maybe it's just the way my mind works, but I feel like I need to start something and then finish something. The idea of starting something and finishing it 4 years later is just over, like, just, it doesn't sound like fun to me. It sounds like torture.
It's definitely different.
Yeah, I mean, it's different, right?
It's different from clicking send at 10 a.m. and seeing your story up at 11:30.
That's the other thing, you know, but there's also this. Okay, so like, I work on a column today, and I'll file it this afternoon, and people will read it. And maybe people will like it. That's terrific. Maybe people won't. But if they don't, I get another shot tomorrow if I want it, or tonight if I want it. When you take on something like this, it's a little bit like, to compare it to what we're about to experience in Russia, like the Olympics. Like, you work all, you essentially train, if you'll allow the analogy, you work on something for 4 years, and then you get one shot at it, and then the world takes a look at it. And so I guess my point is, it must be really flattering to see the positive reviews, because if it was the opposite of that, it'd be a hell of a thing to live with, you know?
Yeah. And you don't want to set yourself up for, you know, letting your happiness or lack thereof dependent on whether it be reviews, sure, whether it be reactions, whether it be sales numbers. But that's not realistic, man. I mean, this conversation, we're what, 7.5 minutes in, is like the longest that I've gone without checking my Amazon sales rank. So this
is a record.
But you know, and not only the reviews have been great, Gary, but just the, you know, you know what's interesting is, you know, I wrote a book a few years ago about the championship game between,
sure,
Magic and Bird. That was before Twitter. So now to have people like tweeting me pictures of the book that when they get it in Amazon, and hey, I'm on chapter 6, I really liked it, or maybe they'll ask me a question. So you really get a lot. And then, you know, you can go to Amazon and see all the customer reviews. And so you're going to get a lot of feedback that's even beyond the regular reviews. And yeah, it's been, you know, with a few exceptions here and there, it's been really positive. People really get the book, Gary. That's the thing, is I think people get that this is not just another John Wooden book. I mean, there are lots of them. They're all beautiful in their own way. But this is a real book about a real man, not a two-dimensional figure, a guy, never had any flaws, never had a bad day. No one ever said anything bad about him. Everybody loved him. That's not real life. You know, I wanted to write about that third dimension. I wanted to write about the competitor who almost got censured by the Southern California basketball writers because of his treatment of referees and the way he used to ride opposing players. That's how much he wanted to win. Bill Walton told me that John Wooden and Larry Bird were the two biggest trash talkers he ever knew. That's not something we normally hear about John Wooden. To talk to his players about what it was really like to play for him, how he was emotionally disconnected from their personal lives. A lot of players left their experience playing for John Wooden with real feelings of ambivalence toward him, or even hostility toward him if they were among those who didn't play. It was only later in life they were able to reconcile with him. How insecure he was, like a lot of great achievers motivated by insecurity, and like a lot of people who came out of the Great Depression. You know, he lost his life savings on his wedding day. You know, no matter how much he won and how much treasure he accumulated, he always had the sense it could be gone tomorrow, and it led him to be very thin-skinned in terms of criticism and pressure. It led him to tell stories after he retired about his life and his career that turned out not to be true. And then, you know, as I alluded to earlier, Gary, you know, I really want to write about Sam Gilbert.
Yeah.
I mean, guys like you and me, we've heard so much about him and maybe read a little bit about him, but I think a lot of fans don't know a lot about him. He was a UCLA booster who was a wealthy real estate developer in Los Angeles who, over a period of many years, lavished favors on John Wooden's players that were in direct violation of NCAA rules. NCAA never looked into it, never invented. They hammered the program after John Wooden retired, but never looked into it while he was still coaching. Wooden did not like it. He didn't create it. He didn't orchestrate it, but he didn't do a whole lot to stop it. And so that doesn't really square with the image that we have of John Wooden as this paragon of integrity. So it's not, what I would say to people, Gary, is this, you know, this book is not a takedown by any measure.
Sure.
John Wooden was not a perfect man, and he did not live a perfect life, but he was an extraordinary man, and he lived an extraordinary life, and I just can't tell you how privileged I feel to be able to present what I think is the definitive story of his life.
And it's nice that you were able to tackle it that way, because I think oftentimes, and I'm not trying to compare John Wooden to Martin Luther King Jr., but these significant figures that are sort of larger-than-life figures, you know, there was just a story, and I don't know, like, I'm sure there's two or three sides to every story, but there was supposed to be a biopic made of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life, and Oliver Stone was actually going to write it, and the family basically vetoed it at the end of the day because they said, because Oliver Stone was saying, listen, I want to tell the entire story of Martin Luther King Jr. It's a lot more complicated than just a man of who was at the forefront of the civil rights movement. I mean, he was a flawed man.
Right.
And
womanizer.
Yeah, right. Now, he was a great man, and he did significant things and wonderful things, and as the word you used, extraordinary man, but there's also different sides of him. And so, you know, to tackle an icon in the sport that we cover in a real way, from every angle, is an interesting challenge. And you know, by all accounts, you handled it really well. I wonder though, has there been pushback from the Wooden family or from people connected to UCLA who would rather, you know, the man who has a statue of him right outside Pauley Pavilion be remembered in a very simple way or a more simplistic way?
Well, it's an interesting question. A couple things. First of all, that is something that I was concerned about.
Sure.
And some of that has to do with the way that we've marketed the book and presented the book. We did not lead with Sam Gilbert. You know, when we did the excerpt for Sports Illustrated, for example, we didn't excerpt Sam Gilbert. We excerpted a chapter about Wooden and Kareem because I thought that was a little bit more the essence of the book. So we never presented this is the dark side of John Wooden.
Sure.
You know, keeping in mind it's a 600-page book, which, by the way, it doubles as a doorstop, so people don't want to read the book. They can still buy it and use it as other useful purposes. So I think maybe some of them are still reading it and getting it, but I can honestly tell you, and I'll also say this, and no one's really asked me this, Gary, you know, the family did not cooperate or authorize this book.
Right.
And for a book, it's a different legal threshold than making a movie. You can't use someone's likeness in a movie and make a story. I don't know what the barometer is. Maybe you can. I don't know. But I know for a book. But I can say this. And when I say Wooden's family, it's really his two children, Nan and Jim. They did not do a single thing to obstruct my work.
Good.
There was not a single person, I mean not one, who ever said to me, I'd love to talk to you, but Nan and Jim said no. In fact, I know specifically certain people who called them and asked if it was okay, and their answer was always, we're not saying yes, we're not saying no, you do what you want.
Sure.
So I can't ask for anything more than that. I haven't had any blowback at all, and I really think the reason, Gary, is people have much more tolerance than we give them credit for to have an honest, fair, and respectful an empathetic discussion of somebody's flaws. And by the way, it's not just Wooden's flaws, it's the flaws of the world around him and what it was like to be in that fishbowl and the pressure of being, number one, being expected to win all the time. And then if you lost a game, he would get criticized for losing. And then when he won big, he got criticized for ruining basketball. So you talk about, I mean, the guy had a heart attack, he couldn't sleep. Hypertension. He developed vertigo. He really, you know, his last championship in 1975 was his least talented championship team. So he was on top of his game, but he had to retire because he couldn't take it anymore. So I think people have a tolerance, and I've always believed, Gary, that people actually, when you reveal their flaws and they're revealing their own flaws, they actually become more likable.
Sure.
Become more sympathetic because now we can relate to them. So it's been a pretty interesting reaction, or I can honestly say non-reaction to the book in that regard.
In regard to Sam Gilbert specifically, how much has it changed, you think, since those days in this way? I think coaches can go out of their way to try to stop boosters or agents from providing impermissible benefits to student athletes. But I don't know that they'll ever stop. They can be aware of it and try, but I don't know that it's even possible to stop it completely. How would you react to that statement?
Well, you know, the thing about Sam Gilbert is, as I write in the book, to call it an open secret does not even do it justice.
Sure.
It was not a secret.
Right.
Sam Gilbert, many people don't know this. Sam Gilbert represented Lew Alcindor / Kareem in his contract negotiations with the NBA.
Right.
He was Bill Walton's agent in the NBA, Sidney Wicks, Marcus Johnson. He was the de facto agent for all UCLA players. In fact, you know, Lefty Driesell told me a story when he took Maryland to play in Pauley Pavilion. He called Wooden to ask for advice about how he was going to handle, I want to say it was Len Elmore and John Lucas, about whether or not they would turn pro. And Wooden suggested that he meet with Sam Gilbert. And Lefty came to town and had lunch with Sam Gilbert. Nothing came of it. But that's how public it was. Jim Murray, the legendary sports writer for the LA Times, wrote a column that Sam Gilbert was more important to UCLA than the building of Pauley Pavilion, because Sam Gilbert was the one who convinced Lucius Allen and Alcindor to stay when they wanted to transfer. And how did he convince them to stay? He didn't, you know, there was nobody, and that actually surprised me. Nobody said to me, he gave me money. It was not a straight cash deal. Now, he gave the money for their game tickets above face value. That was a violation. He could point them into restaurants and they could eat at restaurants and not have to pay. They'd go to clothing stores and not have to pay, or they'd get a discount on cars, discount on rent. So, you know, when something is so much out in the open like that, Gary, you can't help but say the coach has an ultimate responsibility for his program. And it's not even – like a lot of the stuff viewed through the prism of 2014 almost seems kind of quaint, you know.
Sure.
The difference is, and where I think Wooden is most exposed to criticism in this area, is that Wooden held himself up and allowed himself to be held up by others, largely through his insecurities, as this great principled man. I mean, you know, he retired in 75 and spent the next 35 years of his life writing books and lecturing and giving interviews and talking about integrity and, you know, sticking by your principles no matter the cost, and, you know, holding himself up basically as someone who was different from the corrupt enterprise of college basketball. And that's why someone like Bob Knight, and I detail this in the book, Bob Knight never cared for John Wooden, largely because, you know, Bob Knight was always disparaged for his behavior, rightly so, I might add. But one thing I have to say about Knight now, there was never a whiff of impropriety with respect to the NCAA. You can't say that about most of the guys he was coaching against. And you can't say that about Bob Wooden. He always resented, you know, that Bob, you know, the Indiana native, was this clean living, non-cursing, non-smoking, non-drinking guy, you know, never cheated, never did anything wrong. When all along, Bob Knight and everyone else in coaching knew exactly what Sam Gilbert was doing. So, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, life is complicated, and this is definitely the most mixed part of John Wooden's legacy.
I find that to be even true today, that, and I listen, I'm not going to call John Wooden a hypocrite, but when you present yourself in a certain way and people in your industry know that you're not that way, it can come off as hypocritical on some level. I find it true even in 2014 that the coaches who are, I guess, most disliked or have eyes rolled at them most often are the ones that are perceived as they talk a certain way and act a certain way, but that's not actually who they are. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, in fact, you know, a lot of his coaching colleagues, they referred to him as St. John.
Right.
That was not a compliment.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I think to be fair to him, you know, he would always be the first to admit, you know, that he wasn't perfect. You know, like if someone said to him, who's the best coach you ever went up against? His answer was always the one with the best players.
Right.
And he was very, looked at himself very clearly. He was not a great game tactician. He wasn't a great strategist. He was a teacher. He got very good players towards the end of his career, and he taught them how to play, and then he got out of their way. And that is what I think is missing most from today's game, this sort of controlling, you know, timeout to timeout, possession to possession style of basketball that I think is really unfortunate, because I think John Wooden's true genius as a coach was – you know, I mean, he would go into the locker room before there was no fire and brimstone speech. He wasn't Newt Rockne. He would say, look, I've done my job. I've taught you in practice. We've worked on everything. When the game starts, don't look over at me. He never called timeout. Sometimes to his chagrin, there were a couple instances where they lost big games when he could have called a timeout down the stretch and didn't. You know, they didn't have plays. He taught them how to play, and then he watched from the bench with his legs crossed and his rolled up program. And because he was so stressed out, he had to talk to somebody. So he spent the whole game yelling at the refs. So, you know, it's kind of funny. he's a lot more like all the other coaches that we know and cover and write about and see than I think we've realized before. And I think this book, you know, really reveals that.
How much do you think his legacy affects UCLA today? Still lingers and can almost be damaging in some way, because the standard is set. It's such a high place that it's undeniably never going to be achieved again, the record of right. success. But I wonder if it still lingers and has actually a negative impact on the program in 2014. Does that make any sense?
Well, ask Ben Howland.
Yeah.
Not only was he fired after winning a conference championship, you know, the guy went to three Final Fours. There's not a single banner hanging in Pauley to commemorate that, because they only hang banners for championships. But Gary, I would actually argue that it's not just UCLA. I mean, I think it's all of sports and all of college basketball. I mean, people don't realize John Wooden was at UCLA for 16 years mm-hmm. before he won his first title. In fact, he was there for 14 years before he won his first NCAA tournament game. I don't think Steve Alford's making it 14 years without winning a game. I don't think, you know, I mean, nobody is.
Nobody at a major conference program could go 14 years without winning an NCAA tournament game. Now, I know the NCAA tournament's different today than it was then, but still, the point remains the same.
Absolutely, and that's the world that he definitely helped create. So, you know, it's an interesting question. It's, you know, but by the same token, the world that he created now in 1975,
right.
John Wooden won his 10th NCAA championship. You know what his salary was, UCLA?
Tell me.
$32,500.
Wow.
So, you know, as my wise old late Jewish grandfather used to say, you make $10,000 a year, you put up with $10,000 worth of crap. You make $100,000 a year, you put up with $100,000 worth of crap. So I can't even imagine the crap that Gary Parrish
on
a daily basis. So, you know, these coaches and, you know, before I came on here, not to name drop, although I am, sure. I mean, I hung up with Coach K doing his radio show. I mean, he's got a lot of pressure and deals with a lot of crap, but he makes a lot more than 30. I think he actually made 32.5 during the 20 minutes that I was talking to him.
Oh, so, I guarantee you it was something.
A lot of changes since 1975.
It's interesting. Again, the book is called Wooden, A Coach's Life. You can get it anywhere you get books, most notably, I guess, at Amazon.com. I do want to talk to you about some college basketball topics in the present. And yep. One thing that interested me was a tweet you had last night about Wichita State. And I don't know why it's so hard for people to grasp this, but it is, and you put it, I thought, really, really well. Obviously, if Wichita State played in the ACC or the Big Ten, they would not have the record that they have. As of this moment, still an undefeated record, 24-0 heading into this weekend, which is probably their last significant road test. But there are only, and I pointed this out earlier in the week, there's only 15 teams in the country who still at this moment haven't lost to a team outside of the top 50 of the RPI. In other words, damn near everybody loses to inferior teams. And there is something to be said if you never do that. And Wichita State to date has never done that. Why do you think that's so difficult for some people to wrap their heads around?
Well, some people are not very bright. and most of them are following you and me on Twitter.
Right.
So God bless all
God
of
bless
them.
All of them.
No, I'm being facetious, please. But half facetious anyway.
Yes, half. Me too. I'm a quarter.
Right, a quarter facetious. But you know, it's, and the other thing is, as I pointed out, like, you know, they did make the Final Four last, like, this is
right.
basically the same team that made the Final Four last. They're already proven. Like, do we forget how they dominated Pittsburgh and Gonzaga? Number one seed Gonzaga. And by the way, they gave Louisville a far tougher test than Michigan. I mean, Louisville was so lucky to win that game. And remember the late held ball call? I mean,
yeah, if Malcolm Armstead doesn't get in foul trouble, it might go another way. I mean, yeah,
I think they had him down. I want to say, was it 11 or
yes.
14 or something like
yes.
that? 11 with 14. So, you know, listen, I mean, people are always going to want to take their shots, but What this team is doing, and I'll even throw in, by the way, in a timely fashion, what San Diego State is doing.
Yes.
Them to lose, I mean, people don't realize they're the new Gonzaga. I mean, they're beating Gonzaga for recruits out west. He's got an unbelievable class coming in. They lose by far their best player, first-round draft pick from last year, and they're better. I do think that people are finally understanding, as I've said for many years, in college basketball, the world is flat. And just because your name is Wichita State and not Michigan State, that doesn't mean you can't play. So, and also, let me add this, Gary. There is a special achievement and designation to perfection. The difference between no losses and one loss is a hell of a lot bigger than the difference between one loss and two losses. And the idea that Wichita State could go the whole regular season undefeated, or even especially go into Selection Sunday undefeated and not be a number one seed, that just would never happen. Like, people don't get that. They're going to be a number one seed if they're able to do that. Perfection is special. And if they, you know, remember St. Joseph's, when they did it, they lost the first round of the conference tournament. If they finish, and they may get there anyway as a one seed, and that's really more important than being ranked or being perfect. But if they finish the regular season perfect, undefeated, then Wichita State, even if they lose in the first round of their conference tournament, should absolutely be a number one seed.
Well, it's interesting to me, the point you highlight, which is they were in the Final Four last year, and this team is actually better than that team. By, according to the coaches, according to most people who watch them, according to all the statistical analysis of it, everything, this team's better. And so usually, even with Gonzaga now, when Gonzaga's rolling through the regular season like it did last year, people will still go, yeah, but, you know, can a Mark Few coach team from Gonzaga actually make a run to the Final Four? If that's a fair question to ask of a program from a non-power conference that's never actually been there, fine, ask it. But you can't ask that of Wichita State. They've done what you're wondering if they can do. They did it less than a year ago.
Right, with the same guys.
Yes.
And what people, I think, don't realize about them for last year, as you and I know, because we're nerds and we follow this every step of the way, is, you know, they had a lot of injuries last year.
Yes.
So they were, what, a 9 seed in the tournament? I mean, legitimately, at full health, they are more like a 3 or a 4 seed.
Sure.
And absolutely played like that. And I don't think anybody had any idea that Ron Baker, the bucket maker, was that guy. I remember Jamie Dixon came to the studio in Atlanta that first week, or the second week, I guess it was, and all he could talk about was Ron Baker, because they just added him. And I knew he made some shots, but I had no idea he was this good. No idea. So aren't they just so fun to watch? I love watching them play.
They're terrific, and they're like a fun group of guys too. And they don't seem to take themselves too seriously. I guess by definition, when you have been recruited to Wichita State, it almost without exception means you've been overlooked by other places. And so they inherently have chips on their shoulders, but they're not walking around saying we deserve more respect. They've handled this. Their fans have a little bit of that in them, and maybe that's just because their fans are active on Twitter. But the players and the coaching staff, they've handled all of this remarkably well. And I do find myself, hoping that they finish the regular season undefeated and head into Selection Sunday undefeated, because I'm a fan of stories, and that would be a great story. Another great story is one that you referenced a minute ago, and that's what's happening out at San Diego State. The idea that this could happen at San Diego State, consistent greatness, or at the very least really goodness, is remarkable given the history of San Diego State. Like, I don't know, people, like, there was just, maybe it was a couple years ago, they had never actually been ranked in the top 25 ever, and now, like, they're in the top 5 of everything and are consistently good. The other thing that I find fascinating is that it's with a coach who had, you know, essentially already had what we thought was going to be his best run ever. And in this sport, probably more so than any other, like in the NBA, guys get recycled. In the NFL, guys get recycled. College basketball, guys don't really get recycled. You can be Jeff Capel as the coach of the number one team in the country at Oklahoma, and then suddenly sort of just be on Mike Krzyzewski's bench at Duke. Now, I think Jeff's going to get another opportunity, but the fall is pretty significant in college basketball for coaches who, quote, fell. And you almost never climb back to a job as good as the one you had before. And yet here's Steve Fisher in the second act of his life running a legitimate top 15 program. Like, that, this is very rare stuff.
And how about this? This ties in with what we were saying. And I was actually looking at this last night, because I was writing something about him. In his first 10 years, Gary, first 10 years at San Diego State, Steve Fisher took his team to the NCAA tournament twice.
Right.
He was there, and they lost the first round both times. He was there 10 years before anything started popping. And this is why, you know, we both do all these radio shows and answer these Twitter questions and blah, 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 blah. It's like people in Maryland are all over Mark Turgeon. I'm like, dude, back off and give him time. Because, by the way, you want to get rid of Turgeon, that's only solved half your problem. You got to hire the next guy. And if memory serves, it didn't go so well for you last time, did it? You know, he ended up – there's a reason he was your eighth choice.
Right.
And it goes back to, like, what you were saying about UCLA. We live in a world – and I try to explain this to my new neighbors on the West Coast. They don't want to hear it. We live in a world where the head coach of Virginia Commonwealth University said he would prefer to be the head coach at Virginia Commonwealth University than be the head coach where John Wooden used to coach at UCLA. That's the world that we're in. If you give these guys time and you support them and empower them, who has a better who has better fan support right now? Of course, everyone loves a winner than San Diego State and the show and the atmosphere in that arena. I mean, it takes time. And you have to take a flyer on someone like Steve Fisher. And you know what? He comes off as this school marmish guy. And you can't imagine him ever putting his foot up someone's behind. But you know what? He must do it once in a while, because his players sure sound like played like they got someone's foot up there behind. So it's a neat – I think it's a great story. The whole thing about it is it's just great for college basketball. And it's great that we've gotten to a point where I really do believe that people – look at San Diego State and say, you know what, that's a great team. They could be in the Final Four, and then they can look at Duke and they say, yep, that's a great team. Could be in the Final Four. Let's get them on a neutral court. Let's toss it up, break out the popcorn, see what happens. It's no more preconceived notions.
It's terrific. Our old buddy John Calipari made headlines earlier this week. They beat Kentucky beat Ole Miss at Rupp Arena. He was asked a question about Willie Cauley-Stein and used that as an opportunity to talk about how his team has been analyzed more than any team in the history of any sport in any era ever. Now, I'm not interested in debating whether that's true or not, but I will say this. He went on to talk about how he thinks that there are writers out there who don't really think his team is bad. They just want his team to be bad, and so they try to portray it that way. I would point out this is the exact same writers that voted his team preseason number one in the country. So if there was,
don't mess him up with that.
Yeah. So if there has been some change where the writers have decided that we are going to not like Kentucky based on something other than on the court performance, it is a change that happened at some point between November and now. Either way, what do you make of that? Do you think he really believes it, or do you think he's just playing to, as they call it, Big Blue Nation?
You know, with John, you never know. You never know. You covered him at Memphis. I go back with John Calipari. I was a high school – I covered high school sports for the New Haven Register when Calipari was the head coach at UMass. Right. So I covered Marcus Camby in high school. You want to talk about blood on the floor?
Oh, wow.
So I know Cal a long time. And you know what? He's just pushing buttons. I mean, the only people he's talking to are his players. And the fact is that – I mean, Willie Cauley-Stein is a great example. I mean, the dude's got no motor. I mean, you need a motor just to find his motor. Right. And John's pulling his hair out with the kid. And he's got, on the other hand, he's got a guy like Julius Randle who literally runs through walls. And it's fascinating. I really like his team. To me, they're like this new school team that's playing old school, has to win with old school basketball. They got to out tough you. They got to get to the foul line. They got to beat you on the glass. They're not going to beat you by jacking up threes and running you out of the gym, you know, like Patino's old Kentucky team. So, you know, whatever he needs to say to get his players to play a certain way, I'm all for it. But I don't think anyone takes seriously the notion that writers are rooting against Kentucky. I mean, hey, let's be candid. Let's ask our bosses at CBS how they would feel about Kentucky being in the Final Four. It's just not factually true, but that doesn't mean I have a problem. I got no problem with them saying it. It's just not factually true.
Yeah, I haven't looked it up, but people seem to reference this all the time on Twitter. They say, all you do is write about Kentucky, or you write about Kentucky all the time, or you write about Kentucky more than you write about anybody else. And the reason is they are hugely relevant, and there's an audience for it. And so not only is it better for CBS Network, it's better for CBSSports.com. It is better for all of us when Kentucky is great, if for no other reason than selfish reasons, which is we all spent most of the preseason talking about how they're going to be great. We're the ones that get called stupid when they're not, you know. To the extent that I root, I want Kentucky to be really good, because I think the sport is more attractive to the casual fan when the Kentucky Wildcats and John Calipari are really good. It brings in an audience that otherwise might not pay attention, right?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, listen, last year wasn't as fun without Kentucky in the mix. It's just better whether you want to root for them or root against them,
right.
It's like I always say about the Duke Carolina rivalry.
Yes.
I mean, you can say you hate the other school, but it's a lot more fun when both those teams are in the top five than when one of them is, you know, six and the other one is 500. That's no fun.
The last thing I want to touch on before I let you go is the Doug McDermott story that we're watching unfold. This is a kid who was quite literally a mid-major recruit coming out of high school, and it's not because nobody saw him. He played high school basketball with Harrison Barnes, who was the consensus number one player in the country. Mike Krzyzewski saw him. Roy Williams saw him. Everybody saw him. And the truth is, they decided, just like his dad decided, they didn't think he was good enough to play at that level. He ends up at Creighton for some very random, if not for Dana Altman taking the Oregon job, right. The Creighton job never opens, and Greg McDermott never takes it, and then Doug McDermott never comes to Creighton, and so on and so forth. And yet he is on track to become a 3,000-point scorer. He's on track to be the first AP first team All-American in three-time AP All-American first team in several decades. I know that he's getting a lot of attention, and maybe this is just in my own head, but it feels like to me people still don't take him seriously. Folks are constantly trying to discount what he's doing, and I understood it on some level when he was in the Missouri Valley Conference because they say, what would happen if he was in a major conference? Well, I always thought if he's in a major conference, he'd be putting 25 on people the same way. Now he is in a major conference, and I know the Big East isn't the Big East that you and I grew up with or even the Big East we had last year, but it's still a league that has programs like Marquette and Georgetown and St. John's and Providence, and yet he's dumping, he put 39 on St. John's. Carmelo played against St. John's. He never put 39 on them. A lot of great, Kimball Walker played against St. John's. He didn't put 39 on them. And yet I still get pushback. Do you sense that?
I exactly agree. And let me just take that as my, and I got to hop off here, but
sure.
Make the broader point. And I know you've noticed I've been on my soapbox about this. This whole thing, A, with freshmen, and B, with the NBA, I'm tired of it.
Sure.
I'm pulling my head out. And this is not about putting too much pressure. I'm not worried about putting too much pressure on Andrew Wiggins, okay? I promise you, I haven't lost a wink of sleep about it. I'm talking about a business perspective of serving our customers. The people who are listening to you and me talk right now are far more interested in whether Andrew Wiggins can lead Kansas to the Final Four than whether or not he's picked second in the draft or fourth in the draft. Now, some of it is because, you know, we don't work for a network that has the NBA.
Sure.
I understand that ESPN has an agenda, and maybe if CBS had the NBA, I'd be getting more pressure to talk about it. But the reason it's Doug McDermott, and the other one is Aaron Kraft. I mean, can we just – we've got 2 months, not even 2 months, to watch Aaron Kraft play basketball. I want to savor every second. Because I know he's not going to be in the NBA, and I couldn't give a flip right. that he's not going to be. It doesn't diminish in my view. So everything becomes about, you know, the one and done and who's got next and where are we going next. And I'm like, hey, it's the first week of February. The Super Bowl, thank God, is over. Everyone's coming to college basketball. What Doug McDermott is doing is literally historical.
Yes.
It's literally historical. So you know what? Catch him while you can. I think he's going to be a good NBA player, whether he's an all-star, whether he's Jimmer, I don't know. But I know this, he's the best player in America. He's going to be the National Player of the Year. It should be unanimous if things go the way they're going. And I salute you for raising this with me, because people need to watch this kid and watch what he's doing, because every time he takes a dribble, I just want to watch him and savor it. And enough with the NBA draft. First of all, the NCAA tournament is more popular than the NBA playoffs. And the tournament happens in March, and the NBA draft happens at the end of June.
Right.
So one thing at a time, Gary Parrish.
I'm with you. Seth Davis, bless your heart for being here. Everybody go buy Wooden, A Coach's Life. Again, you can find it anywhere that you get books, including Amazon.com. I appreciate all of you listening to the podcast, for following us on Twitter, for reading what we write and listening to what we say. Remember, you can subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast over on iTunes, so make sure you do that, and we'll talk again really, really soon. Thanks so much, Seth.
Thank you, Gary.
All right, buddy.